Good evening, everyone. Welcome once again to the Sunset Cultural Center in beautiful Carmel by the Sea for the Leon Panetta 2016 Lecture Series. We are now more than halfway through this year's season on whether or not the future will bring an America in renaissance or an America in decline, and the challenges facing a new president. Tonight, we turn our focus to gridlock, partisanship, and executive action. James Madison and the other founders intentionally designed a sharply limited government. They created a system of checks and balances to prevent centralizing powers in any one branch of government. It is a system that requires that we elect to work together. And when our leaders don't, then gridlock is the result. Today, the president and the Congress, Republicans and Democrats, are so divided that they're unable to govern. They cannot find consensus on major issues facing this nation, on immigration reform, the budget, funding infrastructure, trade, and war authority. They are now divided over how to address the vacancy on the Supreme Court. How did we get to this state of affairs? And more importantly, how can we reverse this dangerous trend? Can a new president and the Congress work together to govern our nation? Can the next president break the gridlock, or are we in for four more years of paralysis? What role will executive orders play in a new administration? Do we need to reform campaign financing and the redistricting process? Tonight, these topics will be discussed by some of the nation's most respected political analysts and journalists. Among them, they have worked as staff to presidents, managed presidential campaigns, and held elected office. Tonight, we'll ask them to look at the current state of our political system, the impact of this historic campaign, and where we go from here. Can our democracy regain its vitality? How do we make this happen? Our first guest has worked in Washington throughout the administration of 10 United States presidents. He served in the United States Marine Corps before going to Washington in 1965 for U.S. Senator William Proxmire. In 1968, he joined Robert Kennedy's presidential campaign and later held leadership positions in three other presidential campaigns. For 11 years, he helped manage campaigns from the courthouse to the White House in some 38 states. In 1979, he turned his focus to journalism and began writing his now nationally syndicated column for the Washington Post. In 1988, he became a moderator and a panelist on Capital Gain, CNN's landmark political debate program, and spent 17 years on this show. Today, he continues his 28-year post at PBS NewsHour, providing weekly political analysis and commentary on national campaigns. Additionally, he is a regular panelist on Inside Washington, the weekly public affairs broadcast on ABC and PBS. He is the author of the well-received book, On the Campaign Trail, which detailed the 1984 presidential campaign between Walter Mondale and Ronald Reagan. An experienced and distinguished commentator, please welcome back Mark Shields.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Our second guest is a former member of Congress, author, ordained Baptist minister, businessman, and celebrated collegiate football player. Elected to Congress representing Oklahoma's 4th Congressional District in 1994, just 4 years later in his term, he was named chairman of the Republican Conference, the 4th ranking leadership position in the majority party. He served for 8 years on the House Armed Services Committee and authored legislation to create the House Select Committee on Homeland Security, which became the law and on which he later served. He also served on the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, as well as the Banking Committee. He co-authored the Community Renewal and New Markets Act, which President Bill Clinton signed into law in 2000. Additionally, he was the author of President George W. Bush's faith-based initiative, the Community Solutions Act of 2001. Deciding not to seek a fifth term in Congress, he is now chairman of a Washington, D.C.-based multi-industry company with diverse holdings that includes the first African-American-owned John Deere dealership in the United States and public affairs consulting company. He is the author of two best-selling books, including the autobiography, What Color is Conservative? My Life and My Politics. Please welcome J.C. Watts.
Well, thank you all again for having me.
My pleasure. Our next guest is senior political analyst for CNN, known for her hard-hitting analysis of policy issues and political developments. She began her career as a reporter at the Washington Star in 1979. During the next three decades, she served as a political columnist for U.S. News and World Report, chief congressional correspondent for Newsweek, co-anchor of CNBC's Capitol Report, and national political correspondent for CBS News. She joined CNN in 2007 and now serves the network's senior political analyst, appearing regularly across the network's primetime programs. She plays an instrumental role in the network's daily coverage while reporting on a variety of political and breaking news stories. She has been a prominent part of all recent CNN election coverage, and she was pivotal to CNN's Emmy Award-winning election night coverage in 2012. She also played roles in the network's political coverage for the 2010 midterm elections, as well as the historic coverage of America Votes 2008. This earned CNN a George Peabody Award. During Secretary Panetta's time in Washington, Ms. Borger stepped in as moderator for several Panetta Institute lecture series discussions on politics and the campaigns. An experienced political analyst, please welcome Gloria Borger.
Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you.
One of television's most recognizable political journalists, our final guest has been following American politics since the first Eisenhower campaign. He served in Africa in the Peace Corps before beginning his career in politics. He was staff assistant to the Senate Budget Committee until 1977, and later a speechwriter for President Jimmy Carter and a top aide to Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill. In the late 1980s, he became the Washington bureau chief for the San Francisco Examiner. He began his career in television in 1994, and 3 years later, he launched Hardball, an hour-long daily news show filled with in-depth political analysis and fiery debate that airs on MSNBC. He has been on the air every weeknight since. Recently, he and fellow political talk show host Rachel Maddow teamed up to anchor MSNBC's primetime convention coverage. The pair joined forces again to cover election night 2012. He is the author of six best-selling books. This includes his most recent, Tip and the Gipper, when politics worked. This describes how Republican President Ronald Reagan and Democratic House Speaker Tip O'Neill overcame their own political ideologies and worked together for the benefit of the country. He not only analyzes the news in recent weeks, he has made news. Please welcome Chris Matthews. And finally, of course, moderating the discussion is the man who created this lecture series 19 years ago. With more than 50 years in public service, he knows firsthand the importance of bipartisan cooperation and believes that working across the aisle brought about legislative accomplishments such as the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary and the 1997 bipartisan budget agreement. Please welcome Secretary Leon Panetta.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this, our third forum of the Panetta Lecture Series. Our theme has been an America in renaissance or an America in decline, the challenges facing a new president of the United States. We've talked about terrorism, foreign policy. We've talked about the economy. Tonight we're going to talk about an area that is fundamental to any president, the ability to be able to get things done, the ability to break the gridlock in Washington and really be able to accomplish things on behalf of this country. Like the members of the distinguished panel that we have this evening, we've seen Washington at its best and we've seen Washington at its worst. The good news is we've seen Washington work. We've seen Republicans and Democrats work together on the key issues facing this country. The bad news is that in 50 years of public life, I've never seen Washington as dysfunctional as it is today. So a new president, on entering the Oval Office, is going to have to confront this challenge. And the question is going to be, can that individual make Washington work for the benefit of the American people, or are we in for another 4 years of paralysis, which would be damaging to the future of our country? So that's the issue we'll explore this evening, along with a few other interesting issues that seem to be going on today. But let me start with the first question. If a new president gets elected and calls you up and asks you to the Oval Office and basically says to you, look, I want to be able to break this crazy gridlock, this dysfunction in Washington, because I really want to be able to get things done. You know, all of you have had your own experience in Washington. Mark Shields worked for Senator Proxmire when I was working on the Hill. He's seen Washington work. Chris Matthews worked for Tip O'Neill and wrote a book on Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan working together. Gloria Borger used to cover the Hill during the days when it did work together, so she's familiar with Washington working. And J.C. Watts was elected in 94, and even though it was a tougher time, the fact was that Bill Clinton was working with Newt Gingrich and was able to get things done for the country, welfare reform, budget agreements, et cetera. So they've all seen Washington work. So if a president calls you into the Oval Office and says, what do I need to do in order to be able to break this gridlock and govern, what advice would you give him?
I would tell my husband to stop kidding around and get off the phone. I'm not so sure the president would be calling me, but call me.
Well, that's true. That's true. Mark?
Thank you very much, Mr. Secretary. It's great to be here. Leon and I both worked on Capitol Hill on the Senate side some half century ago, when in fact it literally did work. And I guess I would say, even though I worked for Democrats, including Robert Kennedy here in the California primary in 1968, that the model I would follow would be that of Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan, first of all, hired as his chief of staff a person who had run the last two campaigns against him, Jim Baker. Jim Baker had run George Bush's campaign against Reagan for the 1980 nomination when voodoo economics was first applied to Reagan's ideas, and run Gerald Ford's campaign in 1976, which was a bitter fight when Ronald Reagan failed to get the nomination in Kansas City. He reached out and had that level of personal security and comfort in his own skin that he could ask Jim Baker to be his chief of staff. And Baker, present company accepted, was the quintessential chief of staff in terms of mastery of policy, politics, and the press. But I'd say about Ronald Reagan is that he had about him a comfort level and an ability to laugh at himself. If there's one thing the next president better have is a likability in dealing with not simply the American public, but we in Washington don't make anything. All right, let's get that straight, okay? We don't grow crops. We don't build computers. We don't build airplanes. We don't even make movies. So in Washington, when you have trouble measuring output, our tendency is to measure input. So what'd you do yesterday, Mark? Hey, I was here at 7 in the morning. What'd you do? I didn't leave till 6:30 last night. I mean, I can't tell you what I did, but I can tell you how long I didn't do it. And so, you know, we get a little bit puritanical about, you know, people spending long hours in the office. Jimmy Carter, God bless him, was in the office before breakfast and not frequently there until midnight. Ronald Reagan came and he kept banker's hours. He was not in the office before 9:30. He was never in the office after 4:30. So we in the press, who are just a pain in the neck, started getting on, is he really up to the job and this and that? So the first off-the-record dinner Ronald Reagan has with reporters, he stands up and he says, you know, they tell me hard work never killed anybody, but I figured, why take the chance? So once he had laughed at his own alleged foible, you know, it absolutely disarmed his critics. I mean, we looked like common scolds. And it's just a great, great strength. I would just add to that the advice that the first piece of advice, I'd say you want a piece of legislation to first out of the box that is important, that there is consensus upon. And I would say what you want most of all is a national infrastructure bill that would rebuild this country. And I think you'd get bipartisan support, and I think it would be in the national interest, and it would be so refreshing to see people in both parties working together.
JC?
Mr. Secretary, I too want to thank you for allowing me to be with my buddies here on stage at the Panetta Institute. Thank you and Sylvia and the staff for showing us a delightful time today. I am an optimist by nature. You know, I'm the kind of guy that I'd go after Moby Dick in a rowboat and take the tartar sauce with me. I mean, that's just kind of my nature. But I somehow know that optimism has been tempered over the last 8 or 9 months. I would say if the president called me, say, Madam President, Mr. I won't get that call, but I assume that I'll say, Mr. President, if I was to get that call, I'd say you can't. Washington has become very dysfunctional, and there's no tragedy in being dysfunctional. We all are dysfunctional. It's just a matter of degree. I'm probably more dysfunctional than Mark. He's probably more dysfunctional than Gloria. Chris is more dysfunctional than all of us. So, but nevertheless, the tragedy in life is not that we are dysfunctional. The tragedy in life is when we allow our dysfunction to become our normal. And unfortunately, dysfunction has become the normal in Washington, and I don't think you solve dysfunction with dysfunction. And I think we've become so concerned about the left wing and the right wing that the poor bird is dying. And I wish I had a solution other than to say that I think we've lost sight of who we are as a nation. And I think it helps us to kind of go back to basics to remind ourselves that my wife, last summer we were driving from Oklahoma to Virginia, where our domicile is, and we went through my hometown, and I said, hey, we're 13 miles away, let's go through old neighborhood, and we stopped and got us some ice cream, and we were driving through the old neighborhood, and I looked over on the porch, and I saw a fella sitting over there on the porch that was kind of sweet on my wife when we were in high school, and I told her, I said, and just this came to me, this witty thought, and I voiced it, and I said, if you'd have married him, you'd have been sitting over there on that porch. And she said, I mean, quickly responding, she said, if I'd have married him, he'd have been the congressman. So I say that to say you got to know who you are. And I really think we have lost sight on who we are. We're not talking about the future in the presidential race. I would mm-hmm. say, Mr. President, Madam President, talk about the future. Mm-hmm. Talk about where you want to, your vision for the country and where you want to take us and how are you going to get us there. We don't have presidential candidates today talking about the future. If you want to know about the future, you've got to tune in to what Google's doing, Microsoft is doing, what you know the Facebook guys are doing, or what Apple is doing. They're talking about the future. And we are that close, I think, to finding a cure for cancer. And we have become so dysfunctional that we're not talking about building our infrastructure, rebuilding our infrastructure. We're not talking about solving educational crisis. We're not talking about defending our nation. We're talking in sound bites. And again, I would say to the president, don't allow your dysfunction to become your normal. Be above that. Get above it. We've got to do that. Gloria?
First of all, I want to defend Chris Matthews. He's not that dysfunctional, okay? let me just say something about Chris. Chris and I go back a long way because Chris was press secretary for Speaker O'Neill, and I was the kid hanging out in the outside office talking to Chris Matthews, who knows more about politics in his pinky than I will ever know. So I will tell
That's
you
right.
That I learned from Chris Matthews. One of the things that I would say, if asked, and that is, first of all, don't overinterpret your mandate. You have to think big, but lots of times people get elected president and they think their margins were larger than they really were, and their congressional margins are different, and they overinterpret. And each president I've covered believes that they're going to be transformational. Some of them will be transformational, some not so much. So that's number one. And the second thing I would say is understand the enormity of every word you speak. Because I'm a pundit, right? There's no enormity. I'm just trying to do my job, and every day I tell you what I know and what I've reported. When you're president of the United States, every mm-hmm. word counts. And you cannot, and you know, chargers are going to be flying back and forth during this campaign. It's not going to be pretty. Once you set foot in that Oval Office, the tone has to change and the restraint has to change because everybody around the world, and Secretary Panetta knows this better than anyone, every word you say matters, and it reverberates throughout the entire world, and we can't forget it.
Chris?
You know, I think it's such a big question. I worked for Tip O'Neill for 6 years, and by the way, thank you for that.
Yeah, that's true.
And it was different. I mean, when Reagan was shot, just to give you a little story that you will remember, Reagan was shot, and Mrs. Reagan was concerned because her husband almost died. The bullet was right here. And they're lucky because Jerry Parr, the Secret Service agent, got him to the hospital in 3 minutes, which was amazing and saved his life. But the trouble is Strom Thurmond snuck in to see Reagan when he was in very bad shape. Remember Thurmond? Nobody's favorite. And he was somebody's favorite because we called him Sperm Thurmond because he was having kids in his 80s. See, I figured out this audience, so I finally figured you out after some thought here. A little pathos here. So Jim Baker was so smart. Mark knows all this business. And Jim Baker was a brilliant choice. He was a very WASPy elite guy. He went to prep school and all that stuff. But he knew he was a staff guy. He knew the job wasn't chief. Mm-hmm. Don Reagan later on thought he was chief. No, chief of staff. You work for the guy who was elected. And Jim wasn't elected. He tried it once. He ran for Attorney General of Texas and sure. got the taste of it enough to know yep. he didn't win. You begin to respect guys who do win. Mm-hmm. And so Jim Baker and Nancy Reagan, who I really got to like at the end of her life because her husband had Alzheimer's, obviously my mom had, we got to be very friendly. And she said, why don't we let the first person to see my husband should be the leader of the opposition. This is how times were different back then. They understood the importance of that signal. And so Tip goes in to see Reagan. And he was in much worse shape than he thought he'd be because they'd sort of covered up how dangerous it was. So Tip, I knew one guy, Max Friedersdorf, he was a congressional relations guy for the Republicans, told me this story. He went in there and Tip gets down on his knees next to Reagan. He holds both his hands and they recite the 23rd Psalm together. He's watching all this. And then he kisses Reagan and says, I don't want to keep you. That we're all in this together mood that captured, I think, powerfully, is missing. You know, I just don't think they feel like they're all in this together. They don't feel like, you know, we could have an immigration bill. We live out here, you're out here in California, immigration, let's get it straight. Like every decent country in the world, why can't we have a law we believe in, we think it's American, the law, and we enforce it. Figure out what's American, pass it, and enforce it. What is wrong with this country? Why can't it do it? You know why? Because the Republicans want one piece of it. They want the cheap labor. The Democrats want the votes. Nobody wants anything to get done. They love dysfunction. It's not an accident they keep screwing up in Washington. They're not clumsy. They know what they're doing. And when they vote for nothing, they want nothing. This is what they often want. So it's not an engineering problem. It's a guts problem and a morality problem. Do you want to do the right thing and get it over with? So my advice to a president would be find a deal you can strike that's useful to the other side as well as your side and help the other side sell it. Don't sit and sell it to your side. That's easy. Help the other guy sell it to his party. So if I was going to sell immigration reform to Republicans, I'd say real enforcement. Number two, real enforcement, illegal hiring. Really do it. If you don't believe in that, don't pass that. But if that's what you believe in, pass it and enforce it. Now, it sounds so rough. Oh, we're actually going to do something? It's so crude. We're actually going to do something. And that's what they're afraid of, is doing something. And Mark is right. Measure hours, don't measure output. Because you can't measure out because they don't ever do anything. And you're right, the only thing we do in Washington is deals, so get the deal right. So I think getting deals right, don't think you have common ground, trade. You want something, I want something, let's put it together. We do it in marriage all the time. All the time, it's deal making, every day it's a deal. We live in deals. You know, we're gonna go visit your relatives. Well, can't we, we've been with your relatives for the last year, can't we go visit mine once in a while? All right, I guess you have a point. You can go see them, but I can't go. You know, but you deal all the time to keep the other person happy, because if the other person's happy, you're not happy. It is a deal. And I think now it's all like, how can you screw the other party, make sure they don't get anything done? That's what it used to be. One party looked out for the other party, make sure they didn't steal the money. Now it's make sure they don't get anything done. The last thing you want is Obama to get credit for immigration reform. Can't let him have that. So we have the Hastert rule. Well, that's a good thing, by the way. I keep remembering that guy. Let's observe the Hastert rule. Let's make that beatific. the Hastert rule. Let's make sure we never allow anything to come to the floor that doesn't have the support of one of the parties, the majority party. So therefore, we never have anything that might have a Democratic support. It might have a majority support. That's what they do. They don't pass anything now unless it has passed the Hastert rule. So all these games to play not to do anything. I think respect the other side's leader. Find deals. And accept urgency. Things have to get done. And we have a debt now because we never dealt with it. And that's why young people today can look forward to a government that spends most of its money paying off debt. And that's why Bernie's doing well, because he can promise everything, but they can't pay it because all we have to do is pay our debts first. You know, we're in receivership. We are, as a country, in terms of military, defense, entitlements, and interest rate. You're almost done the budget with that. That's the problem we got into, because they don't deal with things. So anyway, urgency, respect the other side, and find a deal. That's what you're there for. The only thing we do in Washington is pay deals. Find a deal.
You know, I used to think that Congress was a crisis-activated institution, as in it would act if there were a crisis. And I grew up covering Capitol Hill believing that in the end, people like Leon Panetta would come through and go to the table and cut a deal. I no longer believe that, because we have gone through crisis after crisis after crisis where Congress should have been activated, and it doesn't do anything. As a result, we have no budget. We just have these across the board cuts that take no, you don't set priorities anymore in spending in this country. And, you know, as a result, people just kind of sit back because they can kick the can down the road and there's no hell to pay for it.
Gloria, you know, on that point, when I was in Congress, and Tip felt this as well, governing was good politics. Mm-hmm. Even though you're working with a Republican president, if you're governing, it's good politics for you. And it was. Mm-hmm. Democrats held their majority because we were governing. I'm not so sure that they think that governing is good politics.
They don't. No.
That confrontation and stopping the other party is better politics.
Right. You play defense.
Scoring points.
Yeah.
Jim Wright, Jim Baker, the speaker, you've talked about Mark, he's so smart. He would come up to Tip O'Neill, the leader of the opposition, and secretly go back. Remember that back room Tip had, that mm-hmm. one with all mm-hmm. the knickknacks on it and all that, but no windows? He'd go back in that room and tell him everything was coming as a courtesy. So the Tip O'Neill was never caught off guard. He knew. He respected him. And Tip, on the other hand, not necessarily because they do this because they're generous, but they think it's good politics. Tip, when Reagan first got elected, and Mark, you pointed out he knew what he was doing, Tip said, there'll be no obstruction. We'll have a vote. We'll get this over with. Mm-hmm. He didn't think it would work. That's why he wanted to have a vote. But he wanted everything Reagan wanted to be voted on. And that first year, we did the tax cut, the spending cut, the budget. Everything was on schedule. Tip said, we're going to keep to the schedule. Now, who does that now?
There
who
is
says,
no
let's
schedule.
Make sure the other side gets a shot?
No.
He said, the president's gotten elected, he deserves his day in court, and he gave it to him. You know?
You had a speaker today, Chris, that can't even get his own party's bills up. I mean, Paul Ryan can't even get his own bills up. John Boehner couldn't even get Republican bills up. And it has become more about scoring points and making other person, other team look bad than it is about trying to, you know, move the ball.
So I mentioned the next president. Let's talk about who will be the next president. this has been a wild year.
It's down to two.
the next 6 months are probably going to be even crazier. I mean, it looks like the likely candidate will be Donald Trump on the Republican side and Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side. I mean, they still, you know, Trump is trying to unify the party or maybe not unify the party. Hillary still has to get past, close the door on Sanders. To be able to do it. But let's assume, for the sake of argument, that it is Trump versus Hillary Clinton, who both have high negatives. We're going to November. Is November going to be a blowout in the election, or is it going to be a close election? Mark?
It'll be one or the other. I mean, Leon's asking the man who predicted President Dukakis would not seek a second term. So, I mean, you know, my credentials as a prophet are a little tarnished. But no, I mean, I really do think that at a level, American people have a sense of what a president is and who a president is. Bill Clinton failed that test in the Monica Lewinsky thing. I mean, when you had to get children out of the room when the news was being covered, you know, trying to explain to a child that fellatio was a Roman soldier.
You did it. It's on television.
You can say sperm. I can say fellatio. But and there was a sense. And so George W. Bush in 2000 runs on the basis I'll restore dignity to the Oval Office. I mean, that I will not embarrass you. I'll do it. But Americans have, and this is not a denigration of Clinton's presidency, which was, you know, in many respects, the last successful, really successful presidency the country's had domestically. 23 million jobs created in 8 years and the balanced budget that JC mentioned. But the reality is that I think voters have a sense. Ronald Reagan passed that test in 2000 when there were doubts about him. Jimmy Carter passed it in 1976 when people didn't know him well. But Americans have a sense of who a president is and what a president must be. In the final analysis, the president is the only elected official we all vote for. Yes, he or she is the leader of a party, but most of all, the leader of the nation. Beyond the government, you're the national leader. We don't have a monarchy that reigns. We ask a president to do it all. The first family is the first family. It's a rather unique job description. As an aside, I have to say I do like people who run for political office. That is considered heresy by some people in our profession. I mean, most of us in life have lives of quiet success and quiet failure. If you and I are the final two contestants at challenges to be the regional sales manager of the Great Lakes Coat Hanger Company, and you get the job and I don't, when the local paper announces your promotion, they don't say Shields was passed over because of lingering doubts about his expense account or his erratic behavior at the company Christmas party. Okay? But in politics, it's there for everybody you ever sat next to in study hall, double data with, babysat for, to know whether you win or more likely you lost. I have always admired candidates who could lose with grace and dignity. And in my 50 years in the business, I never saw anybody do it better than the fella in this very state. In a Los Angeles state Senate race when Dick Tuck lost in a very close race, and a radio reporter from KMPC radio, just as the results were announced, stuck a microphone in his face and said, "Mr. Tuck, how do you feel?" And he said, "The people have spoken, the bastards." So I come back to that sense that I've talked too long.
So is this going to be a blowout or close?
I come back to the sense that Americans at the core will find Donald Trump not presidential, whether regardless of what he says or irrespective of what he does. They do expect a president to be someone whom you don't have to shunt the children or the grandparents out of the room when he's about to speak. He's a man, if you took the first person singular pronoun out of his vocabulary, would speak less than Calvin Coolidge. It's I, me, my, me, my, I. And a president, what we look for in a president is a sense of we, who we are as a people, what we might become as a people, what our challenges are as a people. And not am I better off, but are we better off? Are the weak among us more secure? Are the strong among us more just? And I think for that reason, Donald Trump will fail the test of American president, regardless of issues or whatever. I do throw in one caveat, and that is between now and November, there will be a major crisis unanticipated, whether it's domestic, economic,
whether it's a natural disaster, whether it's a terrorist attack or an international conflagration, I don't know. But again, that's when Americans will measure the two aspirants, the two challengers.
JC, you're the Republican here.
Yeah. Yeah, I should get overtime pay tonight. You know, Mr. Secretary, I wish I could tell you who I thought was going to win. I really don't know. We're seeing things in this election that I don't think any of us can say we've seen before. There's some things that would tell me that Mr. Trump's going to have some real issues, and just, you know, the way he's gone through the field of 1,702 candidates, I wouldn't, I'd never count him out. But if, you know, taking off my Republican cap and putting on, you know, my political strategist or my operative cap and saying, okay, how do you get there? How do you create addition and add numbers to your vote count? I just think it's challenging for him. I think most people, 7, 8 out of 10 people, like to vote for candidates they feel like likes them. And when you consider that Mr. Trump has offended almost every demographic out there, and with another 6 months in the election, if you've not been offended, just stand by, hang on. I find it difficult how you can get to 50 plus one. I think it's going to be very, very challenging for him. So I don't know. I don't know who wins. And I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't count him out. I think
really?
The odds are against him to win. But I would not. As I said, I would not.
Do you think he likes? Do you think he likes you?
Well, Mark, flip a coin. he's done things that he's offended women. He kind of lost me on the Carly Fiorina thing. I don't think she deserved that. The way he went after her, and Muslims, African American,
Latinos.
I mean, you name it. He's not left anybody out, and I just think that I think that creates serious challenges for him in an election year, and I think. Senator Clinton, the only thing she's got going for her is that Donald Trump is the nominee. And we are in dire straits in terms of presidential candidates.
Gloria?
I would have to say, though, be careful what you wish for, because the Hillary Clinton people know this, and talking to them, you know, they're not doing dances about the fact that they would be running against Donald Trump. They understand that these are two historically unpopular candidates. They understand that he has a 70% disapproval rating with women, which would mean that he'd have to win an inordinate amount of white men. They understand that the Democrats start out with an electoral college advantage. They get it. Let's just put all of that aside. Nothing has been predictable in this campaign. Mm-hmm. And the Trump people I talk to believe that he can bring out voters in states that are we assume would be Democratic, which would be Pennsylvania,
Michigan,
maybe Ohio, depending who he runs with. And so they believe that they have a shot at it. And one way I think of this election is that I call it, this is not going to be a persuasion election, it's going to be a mobilization election. Seems to me that this is going to be about getting your people to the polls. It's not going to be so much about persuading, because how many people do you know are on the fence? Hillary Donald, Hillary Donald. They're very different. And it's going to be about whether Trump can bring out those people who came out for him in the primaries and then some. And don't forget, these are historically high voting populations in the primaries among Republicans, and whether Hillary Clinton can bring out her own voters as well, including some of those people that feel like he has insulted them. And I think that's what it's going to come down to, which is the old-fashioned, get out the vote, get your people to the polls, and then we'll see. So I'm kind of ducking the question because I really, honestly, have given up predicting anything in this campaign.
But also, let me add, see, I think Mr. Trump has an additional problem with demographics, and one of the another demographic that he has trouble with, I think, are many Republicans.
That's for sure.
I think there are a lot of Republicans that, and I've been a part of an email thread that I've not weighed in on, but about one time in 3 weeks, that, I mean, this group of people, and it's very broad, that they are saying, no way Trump.
But would they vote for Hillary Clinton? Or no, just not vote?
They wouldn't vote.
Right.
I mean, they'd go to the polls and vote downline, which, I mean, that's kind of the argument that they're making. You know, write in a candidate or go to the polls and vote on your downline, because that's one of the arguments that Republicans have made, is to say if you stay at home, our downline's going to suffer. Our Senate candidates, our House candidates, our county commission candidates, our, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not just, you know, Hispanics, you know, Black, women, et cetera, et cetera. You've got an additional problem with there are many Republicans that say, He's a problem.